gives me great pleasure to introduce the Betty Clever Endowed Lectureship for this year. This lectureship was created to highlight the importance of crop science, enhance the programming offered by CSSA, and showcase the distinguished scientists to gain greater visibility to our society. The lectureship was established in 2001 by Dr. Betty Clever, a retired plant physiologist from USDA ARS in Pendleton, Oregon, and former president of the CSSA and former ASF board member. So it's now my distinct pleasure to introduce the 2017 Betty Clever Distinguished Lecturer, Dr. Greg Edmeades. Greg is an independent consultant based in New Zealand. He was formerly the head of the maize physiology and agronomy at CIMMYT in Mexico and research fellow at DuPont Pioneer. He received his BS and MS degrees at Massey University in New Zealand and PhD degree from the University of Guelph. His research programs focus on developing tolerance to drought and low soil nitrogen in maize, and Greg spent 5 years in Ghana as an on-farm agronomist, and he has returned numerous times to Africa to review ongoing research projects. Greg also is a fellow of the Crop Science Society of America and has co-authored 57 journal articles, 105 abstracts, presentations and chapters, 17 project reviews, and one book, and he's one heck of a wonderful mentor. Please welcome him to the stage, Greg Edmeades.
If I'm being heard. Can you hear me? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the chairman for his generous introduction and the opportunity to be able to share with you a journey in tropical maize, which has spanned around 40 years, and I have not been part of it. I've just been part of bits of it. But so I'm standing before you representing the work of an awful lot of other people. So, partitioning and passion, potholes and partitions. We've got a lot of feedback here. Okay. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Marianne Batzinger, who is Director of Research and Partnerships at CIMMYT, Ken Fisher and Svekia Bharti. We have all played our part in this long journey. I want to start at the end of the journey rather than the beginning. From Zimbabwe to Malawi, from Ethiopia to Nigeria, Africa has been in the grip of a severe drought in many of the maize growing areas. In 2014-15, for example, Zimbabwe experienced 2 years of drought, one after the other, and by the time we reached the end of the second season, production was down by 52% compared with a five-year previous period. For South Africa, it was 38%. For Malawi, 42%. So, severe drought. And as we speak, the area from Somalia all the way through to northern Nigeria is still in the grip of a pretty severe drought. I want to introduce you to Apollonia. That's Apollonia standing on the left there, holding an ear of maize. Apollonia lives in a village in southern Mazvingo province in Zimbabwe. At that village, by growing drought-tolerant maize in the second of those dry seasons, it was able to generate around about 600 kilos more maize per household. The 30% of the folks in the village that grew drought-tolerant maize were producing this extra maize, and it gave them 9 months more household food. If we move north to Malawi, we find that conservation agriculture plus drought-tolerant maize combined lifts the yield about 40%. So what are the benefits of this? Well, you can see for yourself, resilience, reduced hunger, increased income, and that increased income shows itself in being able to pay the school fees, in being able to go for medical attention. It also pushes out the marriage age for girls, because girls don't have to be introduced to their prospective husbands for dowry payments. The path from the beginning of this work to to where Apollonio is holding that ear, spans about 40 years. I want to start by saying, well, low maize yields in the tropics. Why? Why are they so low? And you can see the panel on the right, the red column is yield, average yield of temperate maize in temperate environments. Then there's the world average yields, and then there's tropical. So tropical is about a half of the temperate yield. And then there's eastern and southern Africa, which is about two-thirds of that. So there's quite a reduction there. Some of the reasons for this are the plant. The plant is a less efficient grain producer. Harvest index of tropical maize is typically about 0.42, whereas that for temperate maize is typically about 0.52, and that 20% difference makes that's all yield. But the most important thing is the environment. The environment is risky. High temperatures hasten development, and so maize doesn't have so much time to capture radiation. The pests are aggressive and changing quite rapidly. The key one here is abiotic stresses. It's tough out there. And so we're dealing with soils which are shallow, which are relatively light in texture. And so frequently you'll find drought occurring, and nutrient deficiencies, sometimes acid soils. And you couple that with an uncertain climate and you've got a problem. Traditional mixed cropping systems also further reduce maize yields. And crop management, frankly, is often woefully inadequate. I want to start with a plant, though. And it's an example of changing partitioning by changing height. This is going back. This is a final photo from a long time ago. And you can see the person on the right is Elmer Johnson. And he's standing under the shade of maize, which is about 3.5 metres tall. And that's the original cycle zero of the composite Taxpeño, which eventually became known as Taxpeño planta baja, reduced plant height. And he subjected that composite to 15 cycles of recurrent forced selection for reduced height, essentially by accumulating alleles with small effects, reducing internode length. And on the left-hand side of the picture, you can see Ken Fisher standing by cycle 15, and it's fully a metre shorter than the original cycle. And here's what you tend to see as a consequence. That cycle zero that Dr. Johnson is standing in after a lodging event, and back behind that is cycle 15 standing very well. Along with this, you can see a change in harvest index, the numbers at the top of the left panel. Harvest index has changed from 0.3 to 0.45. At the same time, grain yield at optimum density has gone up from 4.1 to 6.3 tonnes per hectare. And the crop has become manageable. You can do something with it. So some of these changes had to occur in tropical maize in its early days to try and get it to the point where you could proceed further with selection. I want to talk a little about the environment of tropical maize. This area here experiences drought 1 year in three. Why do farmers grow maize? Because it tastes better than soil. And so they persist in growing maize even though they're going to lose the crop 1 year in three. On top of that, we have situations where, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, where maize is really often nitrogen deficient. So the left side of that picture is a zero nitrogen plot in Kenya. Behind that, 150 kilos of nitrogen, normal-looking maize. In the right panel is in West Africa. The plot in front of these gentlemen has had zero fertilizer also, and the crop back behind has had 90 kilos of nitrogen in the form of triple 15. So these kind of experiences and realities had led Simic way back in 1974 to make a commitment to try and evaluate the chance of improving drought tolerance in tropical maize. The Taxpeño germplasm that I mentioned earlier was identified as productive, stable, and protocols were developed and validated over 8 cycles of recurrent forced selection. So that was done just to see if we could make a difference. Elmer Johnson and Ken Fisher led that work. The results were sufficiently convincing that 5 more populations were added to this in 1986, a recurrent S1 population selection in this particular case, and with about 4 to 10% intensity, rain-free locations. We have the benefit of a dry season down there. You can use that and you can mitigate stress with irrigation as you need to. And there was a pre-selection on all of these under the heat of northwest Mexico. A typical screen would be 3 managed drought stress regimes. Optimal, fully watered, to test for how the yield potential was moving, flowering stress to try and hit maize at its most susceptible time, which is right at flowering, and severe stress. And the yield targets of those were naturally 100% and then 50 and 20%. So we smacked the crop around pretty badly. The traits, grain yield. And Anthesis silvium Law, this is a delay between male and female flowering, and it's a sensitive indicator of a similar supply to the ear. Barrenness, stay green, leaf rot, all these traits were combined together into a selection index and used to select the progenies for the recombination of the next cycle. A slightly different approach was taken in 1988, where we pulled together anything that had drought tolerance better than what we had and put it together into a composite. Now that composite went across colours, heterotype groups, germplasm types. It's taken about 20 years to unravel it, but there was good mixture in there, and we have generated some inbred lines that have been really quite useful in terms of being sources of drought tolerance. What do we find from the gains? We talked about recurrent selection. How much gain do we get? Just look with me for a minute at the light blue line in the middle there, where it talks about average. And so I'll just simply tell you what the average looked like. 166 kilograms per hectare per cycle across all those populations. But what's important here is that there was also gains under optimal conditions. So it's telling us an important point here, that you can improve yield under stress conditions at no cost to yield potential. And another surprise of this data was that red number, 166, under low nitrogen. We took some of these selections and grew them under low nitrogen, and we found that we captured most of the gains, in this case, all of the gains, that we'd obtained under drought, we also obtained under low nitrogen. That came as a surprise to us. And before we leave the slide, you'll see that Anthesis silvium Law also reduced by about a day a cycle. So what was happening here? If we plot grain yield versus Anthesis silvium Law, it conforms to a negative exponential distribution of points. And that applies to so many different types of maize, all the types of maize I've looked at, in fact, from landrace to corn belt. And what selection is doing here is we're driving that curve back up towards higher grain yield by shortening that Anthesis silvium Law. So that's actually the Anthesis silvium Law turns out to be a rather nice phenotypic marker for this kind of improvement in yield. And what else is happening? Well, if we compare the contrasting cycles of Tuxpania sequoia, the original drought population that we worked on, the most recent cycle has faster air growth. That's the red line. And the black line underneath is the original cycle. So you can see these are days after ear initiation. There's not a difference in maturity here. There's a difference in partitioning. What did we do for nitrogen? Well, similar types of things. We had a controlled stress situation established in the lowland tropics. And on the right-hand side of the panel, zero nitrogen applied. On the left-hand side, 200 kilos of nitrogen applied. And we looked at the kind of traits that were rather similar to what we were using in a drought. They were grain yield, they were Anthesis silvium Law, they were stay green, and barrenness. These were the traits that were correlated with yield. We weren't just copying for the fun of it. They actually showed the best relationships with yield. What we did find is what I alluded to earlier, that some of the gains of the drought we were also picking up under low nitrogen, and that worked well at moderate nitrogen stresses, when there was about a 40% yield reduction. As the stress intensified with nitrogen, then nitrogen-specific factors started to kick in. You can see the gains coming from drought tolerance selection weren't transferred fully across to low end. But it was a win-win for a while, because it seemed the most efficient way to select for improved performance under low end was selecting for drought tolerance. This technology had reached the point where it seemed mature enough to take to where it really needed to work, which was in Africa. And here's some experimental hybrids. That's the blue line at the top, four experimental hybrids versus the best commercial checks at the time in eastern and southern Africa, grown across an array of naturally occurring stresses and environments. And there's a fairly clear message from this. The advantage of the experimental hybrids was about a ton per hectare across the whole spectrum of yield. So there was no sense in which stress tolerance was coming at the cost of yield potential. This kind of information encouraged CIMIT to move a lot of its work in this area to sub-Saharan Africa. So the first thing that it undertook was to collaborate with IATA. Of course, IATA in Nigeria had been there all along, and specialising especially in sorghum resistance. It was also noted that heterosis improves stress tolerance. And so there was a move away from populations towards hybrids, and these days about 70% of the releases are hybrids and 30% still are OPPs. CIMIT, of course, had to decentralise and establish testing hubs in Zimbabwe and Kenya, and these days that's about 60 hectares of managed drought stress testing plots, about almost 50 hectares under low N, and nearly 50 for screening under heat. Multi-location testing moves the selections from this system around through sub-Saharan Africa, and there's about 550 of those trials put out each year. This was supported by confident donors. There's no question that donors played a key part in this, and they supported long-term projects. It is a gift from the gods when you have a project that is funded for 10 years, and we have several here that went for that length of time, with checks and balances, but nonetheless they went that length of time. You can see their names, their acronyms, alphabet soup there, but stress is a key factor in all. We had excellent partnerships with national programs and private seed companies, and some public private partnerships, PPPs, with the multinationals. Monsanto and Pioneer both involved in that. What did we gain? Did we manage to make any, was there significant progress genetically? If you have a look at this left panel, that's the result of conventional selection out of Zimbabwe. You can see that the gains there under stress range from 25 to 55 kilograms per hectare per year, something of that order. In the right-hand panel, you can see a comparison that was conducted in Kenya between genomic selection and conventional selection in biparental crosses, 8 biparental crosses, under drought stress. And genomic selection, if you work it out as kilograms per hectare per year, was giving more than twice the gain we were getting from conventional selection. So it looks like there's some clear improvements in rate of progress from this. You'll note that the rates of progress I mentioned for conventional selection are lower than the ones that I reported on from Mexico, in part because this was evaluating a program which was developing finished hybrids which had to go out and meet the requirements for farmers in terms of disease resistance. They had to do a lot of things, not just drought. They had to do all the things that a new variety is asked to do. You know, one of the things that surprises physiologists is selection works. And this is one, this comes as a surprise to all of us sometimes. On the left-hand side of this picture, you can see an unselected population, and on the right-hand side, a population which had undergone 4 cycles of selection for tolerance and flowering, and a comparable germplasm with similar flowering dates. So even a physiologist can be persuaded by this. You don't have to measure that stuff. More commonly, this is the picture you see in the left-hand part of this panel, a contemporary commercial hybrid R201 from Southern Africa, and on the right you can see a larger ear pile of stress-tolerant hybrids that have similar characteristics in terms of maturity and the niche they serve. And so that's been our experience over the years, has been that kind of difference. Now we're getting to the point where we need to speed the breeding, and of course all the things that you see in commercial companies, you see some of here. Genomic selection in real time, the use of production markers for those must-have traits, double haploid technology, about 100,000 double haploid lines are produced each year through a facility funded by Gates and managed by CIMIT, and those lines are available to national programs, are available to seed companies and for CIMIT itself. And that, they of course can be combined with genomic and marker selection. Some single gene effects have been able to be utilised in the Water Efficient Maize for Africa project, WEMA, royalty-free access to Monsanto's DroughtGuard gene and a couple of their CRY genes has been allowed, and these will be hopefully released in 5 countries in sub-Saharan Africa in the next few years, subject to getting biosafety regulations up to speed. And I don't say that lightly, it's taken years and we're not quite there yet. And there is a discussion going on between Pioneer and SIMMET, between the utilization of a dominant male sterol gene, MS44, which gives quite a high level of stress tolerance under low nitrogen. It's kind of a neat mechanism. And you can see in the bottom right-hand picture that high throughput phenotyping is coming. And in this particular case, the traits that are being assessed here are the old traits: plant height, flowering date, stage rate. But they're being assessed by remote sensing, and it's cheaper and it's faster. Okay, where has this all taken us to? In the last 10 years, we have seen 370 drought-tolerant cultivars released in sub-Saharan Africa. Seed production on these is around 70,000 tonnes in 2016, sufficient for almost 3 million hectares. The adoption to date, if I go by a SIMMET annual report, drought-tolerant varieties have been delivered to 3 million farmers across Africa. Are there opportunities still in sub-Saharan Africa? Yes, there's plenty. A 2014 survey indicated that 46% of farmers are still using local varieties, untouched by any improvement. A 2016 survey of 20 major maize producers in sub-Saharan Africa countries would suggest that there are over 300 seed companies. Many of these are small, 97% are private, and 70% of them produce less than 1,000 tonnes a year. And the typical kind of portfolio they would have would be three hybrids and three OBVs available at any one time. So they're not big. They're meeting about 30% of the demand, and some of them are stumbling, some of them are struggling, but it's certainly a positive development. Looking back and saying, what were the ingredients for success in this program? Well, there's a little bit of science that I think was important here, because this was a productive collaboration between physiologists and breeders here. We noted that stress tolerance and yield potential were independent. One was not at the cost of the other. A crucial aspect was managed stress levels and quality phenotyping. So those two things, you needed to be able to manage the assessment of the phenotype. We found that plant-water relations did not change a lot with the selections that we were doing. Mostly it was changes in partitioning, favouring the stronger growth of the ear and a higher rate of kernel set. We also noted that elite maize in every population that we looked at carried drought-tolerant alleles at low frequency, and our task as breeders was to increase that frequency, and that's, I think, the task for us all. I cannot overemphasize the importance of continuous funding for that whole period of improvement. We had generous donors, and I would single out the Gates Foundation in particular for being especially supportive in the last 10 or 12 years, and USAID from the seed perspective. They've done a great job in helping move these seeds out to private companies. I will say, however, that a decline in core funding for CGIAR centres like IOTA and SIMMET is threatening the continuity of their main breeding program, and it's a source of concern for all of us. Throughout this period, another factor in success was flexible, patient and supportive leadership. Now, at the bottom you can see the mugshots of the directors of SIMMET's maize program for the last 45 years, and they were all basically supportive of the work that was done, even though sometimes they didn't trust physiologists fully. Research was motivated by a vision, and that vision was to improve resilience, income and nutrition of vulnerable families depending on maize in variable and marginal environments. Let me tell you that it was not difficult to figure out why you were getting up in the morning and going to work. Sometimes, from other jobs I've held, and that was a difficult thing to determine, but this one, never. There was balance in the research team because people really matter. Mature and experienced scientists were available to mentor young and enthusiastic staff who were keen on making their research careers count. They wanted to do something important for mankind. And of course, there were always our colleagues, national scientists, operating as equal partners under challenging and difficult circumstances. And if you just catch a glimpse of some of the faces that have done this work over the years, there's 40 or more here. I could find another 40 from file photos. But a range of young, of older scientists who mentored, who helped each cohort of scientists coming in to learn their ropes. Notice that the majority of these photos are taken in maize fields. That's the area where these materials that we've selected have to perform. That's the proof of concept round. I would say that that's the challenge to scientists today, is to get out there in the field and see what the plants are doing. Are we there yet, as the kids say when you're travelling? No, we're not. There's lots of gains that need to be defended. And of course, one of the old issues that we face is strike, the plant parasite, that we still, even though RTA has had an outstanding program of investigation over the years, we still don't have full resistance to strike. Maize lethal necrosis. This is a disease reported first in 2012 in East Africa, caused by a co-infection of two viruses, and when they occur together, they can be absolutely fatal. There's a screening centre in Kenya, and 9 MLN tolerant hybrids have recently been released. And that, it sounds like the situation's under control, except when you remember that almost everything that's grown out there is susceptible, and it can be disastrous. And so the replacement, having something in the wings, is really crucial. Here's the big one, fall armyworm. This used to be a pest of the Americas, and in January 2016, it was reported in Africa. By the time I last checked the numbers, it had been reported now in 28 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, suspected in 9 more. So this pest is just chomping across the continent at the moment. Not just maize, but other crops as well. The challenge that we've got here is that there hasn't had time to evolve natural enemies. There is no really good biocontrol that we're aware of, so many, many factors need to be brought into play. It's possible that transgenics may play a role here. But losses could reach $6 billion a year. Heat tolerance, climate change. Heat tolerance appears to be independent of drought tolerance. And heat tolerant hybrids have been released in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And I think Mitch Tynstra has been involved in some of that work, so it's a nice coincidence today. Complementary agronomic practices are essential. It's okay to have improved varieties, but they can only go 20% of the yield gap. That's about all. So the largest yield gaps in sub-Saharan Africa are from soil fertility, then from drought, and then in order might be cultivar and weed control. But the soil fertility issue is critical that it be addressed. Conservation agriculture is a helpful technology if it is going to be adopted. It's essential that we get the agronomy right, so the genotype by environment, by management interactions that these drought-tolerant hybrids could utilise can indeed be employed. Challenges? Is there? Yes, there's plenty of stuff left. So genetic gain, defending and maintaining what we've got, and we mentioned some of the challenges just a minute ago. The other thing that's really crucial here and is often overlooked, the rate of varietal replacement must increase. You cannot enjoy the benefits of improved varieties if farmers don't replace their old varieties with the new ones. And so we still have hybrids in Kenya that have been out there 35 years, and so they were bred for an environment which has long gone. Stable and long-term funding, we've mentioned, recruiting and retaining the best scientific staff. This work demands the best brains in this room, and I issue that challenge out there for all of you. Boosting national research strength. When we're long gone, national programs will remain, and they need to be strong. And partnerships have never been more important than they are today. I'd like to close out pretty much by acknowledging this work that I'm presenting has been the work of hundreds of scientists over the years. And I really like to acknowledge the input of my colleagues, both in the NAS and the organisations I've worked with, the outstanding group of postdocs that I've been privileged to work with. My work, they've been great. Donors. If we don't have donors, we don't have a program. So investors, if you like, but donors. And on a personal note, our families who shared the vision and paid some price for that. I'd like to acknowledge our chairman for today, Dr. Westgate, who for the last 3 decades has been a source of encouragement in a lot of this work as well, and of course has a vested interest in drought tolerance himself. This talk is dedicated really to the resource-poor farming, maize farming families who actually deserve better choices in life. And you see the lady there, if you just look over her, what would be her left shoulder on this side, you can see a baby's head. It's that intergenerational welfare that we're interested in looking at. She had a baby on her back. And, you know, there's whole communities that depend on success in this kind of work. And they deserve a chance to get on an upward spiral of prosperity and food security. Norman Borlaug's comment, "Food, the moral right of all," still stands. Thank you.